The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. Sam, yet another abridged J1 match day on Sunday, but with the East Zone of the ACL up and running and an Olympic squad or two to chew over. Again, we're hardly starved for topics and talking points.
Yeah, that's not to mention Sean and Cashua deciding to go on for almost an entire extra game with the amount of added time there. So, yeah, plenty again to chew over.
Indeed, and we'll delve into all of that after welcoming in our guest. He might be excused for having one eye on the upcoming Olympics, and you've probably seen him all over your TVs and listened to him on various podcasts and radio shows. But he's still, of course, keeping abreast of all the Japanese football topics. From the Japan Times, it's Dan Orlowitz, and welcome back to the pod, Dan. How are you?
Thanks, Ben. Good to be back. Doing good. It's a much quieter week than last week. But then again, as we record, it's only Monday. So we'll see what news the rest of the week brings. But man, I've gotten 8 hours of sleep the last couple of nights, and it's been revelatory, I'll tell you that much.
Brilliant stuff. All right, well, long may that continue for you, Dan. But yeah, I don't like your chances. So we'll actually lead off with the Olympics, and after Sam surprised me on last week's episode by informing me that Hajime Moriyasu would be releasing his 18-man squad for the men's tournament last Tuesday to follow Asako Takakura, who did so the week previously. So we now have some names in the books, Sam, to decide if there are any major snubs or not. So when the men's squad was released, what was your overall opinion?
I mean, I thought it was a very good squad. I don't think there are any major concerns with it. I mean, there was the issue we were talking about with left-back, but they have gone with Reo Hatate and then Yuta Nakayama. They'll probably share that position. But otherwise, yeah, it looks a very strong squad. Just the two strikers might be a slight concern going forward, especially as we'll get on to with Ueda being injured. So maybe a little bit light there, but all the big guns are in the squad, and it looks, yeah, as good a squad as Japan could have put together.
So, Dan, we kind of got a sneak idea of what Moriyasu was thinking with his overage players with the last selection over the international break. So we knew that Maya Yoshida, Hiroki Sakai and Wataru Endo were almost certainly going to be named in the 18-man squad of fitness permitting. So I guess from a selfish point of view, you and I as FC Tokyo supporters, it was slightly disappointing for the likes of Tsuyoshi Watanabe, who'd played such an important role pretty much right throughout the lead up to the Olympics. But I guess, yeah, once Yoshida especially was confirmed as one of the overage players, that meant obviously one less spot for a centre back. And unfortunately for us, and it would have been a great experience for Watanabe, he was not, he didn't make the final cut.
It is absolutely disappointing for Tokyo fans. I mean, for the Olympics to be held in your city and to not get any players called up to the Olympic squad, you know, it's disappointing, and supporters have expressed that over the last week or so. But they're sort of looking forward to, well, you know, there's always the World Cup next year, which is weird and scary, and we probably shouldn't be thinking about that at this time. But I agree with Sam. This is a very solid squad, especially given that they're limited to 18. There's really no fat to be cut from here. And we'll see if the rumors and various reports are true that the IOC has received several petitions to let countries, to let Olympic squads add their backup members to the full squad, so they essentially go into 22 rather than 18. And if you consider that and the four backup members, Zion Suzuki, Koki Machida, Ayumu Seko, and Daichi Hayashi, I mean, it's solid. I don't think you could have done too much better at the under-24 level, and I'm excited to see Mitoma get out there. I'm excited to see Al Tanaka, who just moved to Fortuna Düsseldorf, get out there. Takefusa Kubo, you know, this is a really good squad, given a tough group, mind you. It's not going to be an easy tournament for them, but it should be exciting to see.
Indeed, and I guess not to linger on Watanabe at all, Sam, but I guess, yeah, the likes of Ko Itakura and his versatility meant that he was always likely to be included. Daiki Hashioka, another one. And I guess, yeah, the wild card, the Swiss Army knife, Reo Hatate, obviously can play at left back. He can play wide in midfield, and he can play, you know, nominally as a striker as well. So Moriyasu, yeah, as Dan says, with a limited number in your squad, you want to pick as many versatile players as you can. So, yeah, a few players here that can perform a couple of different roles. I mean, yeah, Itakura could play a defensive midfield if need be. And I guess that was one criticism from a couple of people that I saw on Twitter that, yeah, the midfield, the central midfield might be a little bit light with Endo and Tanaka. Obviously, you'd expect to start as in the two in there. But if there was somebody else needed to be drafted, you know, I guess Itakura could fulfill that role, or indeed Kojima Yoshi as well.
Yeah, of course, and Nakayama as well has played central midfield for the Japan national team, I think, for the Copa America, so there are definitely options there, and as you've mentioned, with the 18-man squad, it's all about having a little bit of versatility in there, because, yeah, Watanabe is a better centre-back than Hashioka, and a better centre-back than Nakayama, if he was put in there, but you have to be able to fill various different positions, especially if you get injuries as well, so I think he's done as good a job as he can with picking this team. The only other one for Tokyo that may have had a look in was Kyosuke Tagawa. Are you disappointed that he didn't make it, or can you understand with the option selected that maybe he was just not quite up to scratch?
I don't know what Dan thinks, but yeah, I mean, he hasn't been given enough of a regular role, I don't think, for Tokyo. And indeed, as I mentioned in last week's podcast, the couple of misses he had in the game against Yokohama FC, they might have been the final nail in his coffin, I think. But yeah, it would have been good to see him in, but I don't think he can have too many complaints. What do you think, Dan?
I think that if you have a squad of 23, maybe he's a backup member. Yeah, I think that's where I'm at. I just didn't see what the team needs and what you need in this tournament from his performances in the friendlies for Tokyo lately. So yeah, you know, it is what it is. Disappointing for him, but as Moriyasu said in his presser, you know, the Olympics aren't the end for these young players, and so now it's sort of up to him to, you know, to up his game and to improve and start thinking about, you know, World Cups and everything else going forward.
So I mentioned Wada earlier, and it came out yesterday that he's out for 4 to 5 weeks. I believe he's already had a week or so out. When's the latest that Japan can make a decision on whether or not he'll be included in the squad? And I'm sure that might change if they do allow the expanded squad.
So from my understanding, the final squads have to be registered on July 5th. So that's the timetable we're working with. And they could theoretically keep him in the squad and then swap him out with a backup member. In this case, it would be Daichi Hayashi, the only striker among the backups. That's dicey because, you know, the backup members are there in case of injuries during the tournament. So it isn't like the World Cup where, you know, the alternates are sort of only up there up until the start of the tournament. So, yeah, that's the time we're working with. It is very much look and see. I assume that they're going to take the next week-ish, I guess they only have a week, but the next few days to look at how he's doing and make a decision, because that's cutting it really close, and I don't think that you want him to go straight into the tournament without any play experience, and so you do want players who can handle those friendlies against Honduras and Spain.
Yeah, Ben, what would your thoughts be on that? Would you be just keen to go, Daichi Hayashi can come in, he's playing well in the J-League anyway, and no point taking the risk with Ueda, or do you think he's good enough to maybe, yeah, wait on him and see if he's fit maybe for later in the tournament?
Yeah, I don't think you have the luxury of waiting, really, do you, Sam? I think if they don't think he's going to be ready for the first game, I don't think you can carry somebody. As we know, yeah, the squad is so low in numbers to begin with, and yeah, only two recognised forwards in the 18. So yeah, if it's a matter of waiting only until next Monday, and you have to, change Hayashi in and put another reserve member in that four-man list, then if they don't think Weta's going to be ready, I think they're just going to have to pull the pin and go with that. So that could mean Tagawa. It could mean somebody else, making the four-man reserve list. But, yeah, I don't think they've got the luxury of waiting for him, basically, despite how good a form he's been in. Yeah, but I don't think they should do it.
Yeah, I think I completely agree with that. And just, Dan, there's another kind of key part of this is that various members of this Olympic squad are out either in Thailand or in Uzbekistan where they're ACL clubs. When do you know if they're going to be able to join back up with the Olympic team? And is there any sort of quarantine measures that they're going to have to take into account, or will they be allowed to just come back into Japan and join straight up with the Olympic team?
So anyone who's overseas and coming back will have to abide by essentially the same rules that European-based players coming back for the bubble games had to follow, which is that they can come into Japan and they can immediately start training with the team. However, they do have to test negative, I believe, the day before the flight, the day they land, daily tests, and they do have to test negative for the 3 consecutive days following their arrival in Japan if they are to play in the friendlies. So I believe the first friendly is on July 12th in Osaka against Honduras, which means that they would have to land no later than July 9th and then test negative on the 10th, 11th, and 12th. In order to play in that game.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I'm just trying to see if that's going to affect any of their Champions League games. Are they going to have to miss one? Sorry, I should have prepared that beforehand.
I mean, ideally, by that point, their teams have things wrapped up enough that they can, you know, send them back home and play the kids.
Yeah, I'm just looking at it now. Kawasaki's last game is the 11th, but hopefully they've... If they can play Daegu on the 8th, would that allow them to get back after that?
In theory, I mean, if they fly back, Kawasaki are playing in Uzbekistan, so if they're flying back, I mean, I don't know offhand if the timing of it is counted from when they land in Japan or from when their flight takes off. That's just not something I remember offhand. There's a lot of weird stuff here. It's like when... Hidemasa Morita missed that friendly. I think, was it March that he missed a game? Like, he couldn't get a flight in time. Or, like, him and I think Yoshida, maybe. And so there's a lot of weirdness, you know, going on. And given that I believe Kawasaki flew charter, and I assume that the JFA would have to arrange something for him to get directly back from Uzbekistan. So that'll be complicated. Or they might decide that, I guess, Mitoma and Hatate can skip the Honduras game and join up in time for the Spain game on the 17th. So that's always an option.
Yeah, there's a lot of weird moving parts there, so it's going to be interesting to see how they kind of juggle all that about. And then just going on to the actual games themselves, do you know if there are any, what the attendance limits have been set for? And is that set to potentially change or increase as the tournament goes on?
Well, it's not going to increase, I can tell you that much. The attendance limit for the Olympics at any venue will be 50% or 10,000. Okay. So 10,000 is the absolute cap, but up to that, it's 50%. So, you know, smaller venues like Saitama Arena that fit about 20,000, you know, they'll be able to go up to the full 50%. But the football venues is going to be 10,000. And, of course, if Japan gets hit by a fifth wave, and let's not get into that too deeply this evening, there is a chance that those numbers could be reduced. Basically, they're going to have to do a second – I shouldn't say second. They're going to have to do a reallocation lottery for all of the football sessions, I believe, because they've oversold all of those well past 10,000. So A lot of people who thought they had tickets to the tournament are not going to be watching it.
Yeah, rightio then. And, well, yeah, so Dan, you've, as we said at the start, you've had one eye on the Olympics for a very long time now. So do you actually have a schedule mapped out from your employers where you're going to be on each day, or is that still a fluid situation?
It's pretty easy right now because I'm actually only accredited for Saitama Stadium. So basically any matches there, I'm covering. There's one game with an 8:30 kickoff that I'm not quite 100% sure on because that is a long haul, Ben, as you are well aware, under the best of circumstances, to say nothing of an 8:30 kickoff. And we're still not 100% sure what the transportation situation is going to be. But I think I will have something like a dozen games in the span of a week. It's something ridiculous just because of the doubleheaders and the fact that it is hosting games for both the men's and the women's tournaments. So we'll see. Fingers crossed. I'd love to get my accreditation expanded, but given the crazy times we live in, nothing can be taken for granted, and I'll just be lucky to get into the building at all, really.
Indeed, yes, the Chaos Energy Olympics, well and truly on the way. So you mentioned, and we've talked about it in passing already, the women's tournament, and Asako Takakura, the Nadeshiko Japan coach, released her squad the week before Hajime Moriyasu did for the men. So we had a question from Alex Bishop on this and overall expectations for the Japan women's team in the Olympic football tournament. Alex says, as is often the case in Olympic football, and Nadeshiko Japan may well go on to outperform their male counterparts. How far can we realistically expect them to go in the tournament, Dan?
I think that the honest, unbiased opinion is they can go as far as they can, as they go before they face the U.S. And however far that is, hopefully it's at the very end. It might be in the semifinals. Could be. I don't think it can be in the quarterfinals. I would have to check the permutations there, but I'm sure nothing's impossible. It's an interesting squad, and one thing that does benefit them, even though it's something we've complained about in that the Wii League obviously doesn't start till September, so these players haven't been getting much competitive field time in. They've had a lot of preseason games and that sort of thing, but they're going to have a lot of time together as a unit. They've been having a long preseason training camps as a national team since the spring, well before that, I believe. And this squad convened on the 21st, and they're going to be together up through the games. So if they work as a unit, and I think that that's sort of what Nadeshiko have to rely on, it's never been a team that is carried on its back by one player. They have to play well as a team, and if they get all the parts moving correctly, we could see something interesting. There's a lot of players who really don't have that much national team experience. Saori Takarada, who plays in Washington in the NWSL, she only has 7 caps, I believe, 6 or 7, according to the JFA. Nanami Kitamura, another defender, has 3. There's only one player who has more than 100 caps, which you don't really see from these really established women's teams. So it's going to be interesting, and the hope is that the experience that a lot of these players have had together at the youth level, at the various underage international tournaments, the success that they saw at the under-17 Women's World Cup, the under-20 Women's World Cup, the hope is that will translate, and that the rebuilding that we've seen under Takakura since she took over in 2016 will result in a medal here. Whatever color it is, it doesn't really matter. If they get onto the podium, it's a huge accomplishment.
Indeed. And, I mean, Sam, yeah, this is basically a mini World Cup, isn't it, the women's football tournament? Unlike the men's competition, it's open age. So, yeah, literally the best players from around the world are representing their countries with no age limit. Dan mentions the United States there. I was actually surprised to remember when I went back to check in prep for this podcast that actually the States didn't actually win the Olympic tournament. I just assumed they were winning everything these days, World Cups and Olympic gold medals, etc., etc. But yeah, the States were knocked out in the quarterfinals last time, so they'll be looking to go one better or two better, or yeah, to win it all again this time around. Where after, of course, Japan didn't qualify for the 2016 tournament, so yeah, they're willing to make up for lost time as well. So what are your expectations for Nadeshiko Japan in the Tokyo Olympics?
Well, it's hard for me to give them a great deal of insight, to be quite honest. I mean, I see the Nadeshiko team whenever they've played in previous tournaments, usually against England. But I'm just not looking past the group stage, actually, with them, Japan, Canada and Great Britain all in that same group. That's a very tough group to be into. I mean, Canada and Britain will both expect to go deep into the tournament as well as Japan. So, yeah, it's a really difficult group to get out of, and you might be hoping that you finish in a third place and just allow yourself to get through. But once you get through that, I mean, it's a wide open tournament for me with the Brazil and the Netherlands as well. And the USA, you want to avoid. But yeah, I'm hopeful for Japan. I'll be following them throughout this tournament. But yeah, I mean, as to where they are or how strong they are compared to usual, I'm really not the person to ask.
All right, and Alex had a couple of other really interesting questions for us, but I think he's probably much better equipped than the three of us to answer them. So we'll hopefully have Alex on before the Olympic football tournaments begin, and yeah, he can share his thoughts on Nadeshiko Japan because he does follow women's football in the country quite closely. So thanks for your question, Alex, and yeah, stand by your inbox because I'll be peppering you to come onto the podcast before the Olympic tournaments get going. Okay, so we mentioned the ACL in passing a couple of times already. You're talking about Kawasaki's Olympic players. So Sam, let's briefly touch on the East Zone of the ACL, which got going early last week, and so far so good, most definitely for all four of the J1 clubs.
Yes, I say it's been relatively plain sailing. Cerezo have played their two games. They didn't look particularly convincing in either of them, but got victories over Guangzhou's youth team and Kichi from behind in a 2-1, quite a tight game, that one. The Nagoya finished off again this morning, or this evening Japan time, won 4-0 against Ratchat Burin. They've become this free scoring team in the ACL, put three past Pohang, which I thought would have been their toughest game, and they've played incredibly well. I mean, Yamasaki got himself a hat-trick earlier, which I didn't think that was possible, and Kakitani's got an absolute cracker against Pohang, so yeah, all going well for them. Gamba played once. They play Jeonbuk in about 3 hours' time as we're recording. They got a decent victory over Tampines Rovers, not particularly convincing, I wouldn't say, and definitely a tougher game to come later on. And game of the round so far was Kawasaki and Daegu. Daegu took the lead twice. Kawasaki were having all sorts of problems defensively, but yeah, they rallied round. Leandro Damian scored one of his trademark overhead kicks, and yeah, they came back and managed to win that game, and that's the toughest game that Kawasaki will play is Daegu. So yeah, all looking very nice for the J-League sides as they move on. But it's been a disappointing tournament when you see there's no A-League sides. The Chinese sides are playing like reserve or youth teams, and as good as it is to see the Thai teams, the Malaysian teams and some of the Filipino teams and all that coming in, the standard is really quite poor compared to a usual group stage. So that's slightly disappointing, but I mean, it's a great opportunity for one of these J-League sides to go on and at least reach the final.
Indeed. So, Dan, what have you made of the results so far for the four J1 clubs, and which teams have stood out to you?
It's been pretty good. I haven't been able to watch all the games, but I've been satisfied with a bunch of wins, a lot of great goals. I agree with everything that Sam just said. This is not a true ACL. This is ACL light, ACL minus, ACL zero. This is for 3.5 really good Japan teams against the kids from China, the scrubs from South Korea, and an assorted bunch of Southeast Asian teams. And that I don't say that to insult any of those teams, but like really, this isn't the potential that the ACL traditionally has. Hopefully we get closer to normal next year. But you know, it's a great opportunity for all of these clubs to leave their mark and to get out of the group stage as quickly and injury-free as possible is going to be the goal. And you know, the more Japanese clubs that are in the ACL knockouts, you know, the better chance we have of winning it. And that's really what we're looking for.
Most definitely. All right, then. Thanks, guys. So let's move on to J1 then. Last Wednesday, there were six games from J1 match day 19 played. Our patrons had the pleasure of reading Sam's detailed match reports on all of the games less than 2 hours after the last game had finished. But if you need a quick catch-up, Yokohama F. Marinos beat Tosu 2-0 at Mitsuzawa to rise to second in the pick of the fixtures, thanks to second-half goals from Marcos Jr. and Takuya Wada. Also last midweek, Kobe rose to fourth with a 5-0 shellacking of Yokohama FC, paced by Kyogo Furuhashi's hat-trick. Urawa continued their climb up the table after a 2-0 win at Kashiwa. And in the relegation dogfight, a late Thiago Santana winner saw Shimizu triumph 3-2 at Sendai, though, as we'll come on to, they failed to build on that result on Sunday evening. And speaking of Sunday evening, that's when six games from J1 match day 20 were played. And we're flipping the script on this week's episode, listeners, and we're starting down, not quite at the bottom, but in the relegation dogfight with a six-pointer at the Lemon Gas Stadium in Hiratsuka, where, at least in terms of talking points, this was the biggest game of the match day. And, well, VAR dominated this game, Sam, so we might as well just play the jingle right off the top. This week in VAR. Yeah, so Shonan hosted Kashiwa at the Lemon Gas Stadium. And, yeah, I knew I was in for a barn burner when I clicked on the DAZN highlights, and it's nudging 10 minutes rather than the standard 6 or 7. You will certainly know you're in for a wild ride when that is the case. Belmare came in unbeaten in 4 and had edged their way up to 13th with their visitors in free fall after losing 7 of their previous 8. And after Shuto Machino turned in Tiger Hutter's low cross in the 18th minute, Sam Raisol looked set for another long evening with the Shonan players busting out to Johnny Nichols' favourite goal celebration after making it 1-0.
I did. I mean, Shonan were much the better side for the entire first half, and Kashiwa didn't really get out of the blocks. I mean, the goal that they conceded was so easy. Hata cuts in, he's under no pressure, he crosses for Machino again, they give him a lot of space, and he turns and puts in a very good finish. But yeah, Shonan were completely dominant, I thought, in that first half, and I wasn't really seeing any way back for Kashiwa at that point, and at various points in the second half. Yeah, Shonan, just generally speaking, this season have been really tough to beat. They've added goals to their game as well, and they looked very good. But yeah, second half, VAR, their arch nemesis, came back to bite them.
Most definitely. And yes, Raisol were handed a lifeline shortly after the second half kicked off when a prone Oliveira raised his arm to block Yusuke Sagawa's shot, with Pedro Raul firing in the spot kick for his first J1 goal. And then this is where VAR took over, Dan, after that penalty decision, which Shonan might have felt a touch harsh on them. There was worse to come when a close-range shot cannoned into a defender and might have brushed Tariq El-Yanoussi's arm before he blasted in the rebound, the referee disallowing the goal after a VAR check. This is one of those where El-Yanoussi, really, there's nothing you can do about it, is there? And whether there was a clear contact with the ball hitting his arm or not, I mean, there's certainly no intent. And to me, his arm was in a fairly natural position, so this felt really harsh.
It was. I agree. It's... Yeah, and so much has been said about the current handball rule, how VAR is being used to enforce the rule. You know, it really is just a shame that Shonan fell victim to this, and the referee just. I think that there are very good ways of managing a game, you know, especially when you have video review, and then there are ways to not do it. And I think that we saw a how to not manage a game with a lot of controversial decisions on Sunday.
And I guess, Sam, for once, Takuya Okamoto was not the victim from a Shonan perspective. But, yeah, poor old Tariq El-Yunusi. I mean, he just can't catch a break, can he? I mean, yeah, fired in a good goal. And you could see how much it meant to him, the way he celebrated with his teammates. And then, yeah, to have it taken away in... well, you can tell us if you disagree and you thought the VAR led to a correct decision or not. But, yeah, for me, it was very harsh.
Yeah, it was very harsh, but that rule is very harsh, and unfortunately, I don't like the rule, but the referee has to referee to the rules of the game, and it does hit him slightly below the sleeve, so technically it is a correct decision. I don't like it, I've not liked any of these that have happened, but especially this one, as there is nothing Tariq El-Yunusi can do about it, it just hits him. But yeah, he's got very unfortunate, it's kind of the story of his J-League career, whether it's decisions going against him, things not quite working out for him, a few injuries, but yeah, it's very harsh to roll it out, but I think once it's called to the referee's attention, he's got no other choice, and I'd be up for changing that rule quite considerably because, yeah, you don't want goals being ruled out, especially for situations like that.
All right, but then Shonan did they catch a break? Or I guess, yeah, ultimately the correct decision was made when Masatoshi Mihara's shot struck the arm of Hirokazu Ishihara, all the Racehold players appealing for a VAR review, and ultimately the referee wasn't called over. So, Sam, this was a case of Ishihara's arm, although it was... slightly, his body was turned to the side, so the shot was struck across him and hit his arm. I guess this was considered to be in a natural position, and again, there was nothing he could do about it, but we know that that doesn't matter. But I guess technically this was okay, and Shonan, they didn't get away with one. This was just one that was able to be wiped away.
Yeah, this is just one where the rules seem really unfair because it hits Ishihara much the same way that it hits Tariq El-Yunusi, but at one end it's a goal is ruled out, at the other end it's not worthy of a penalty because, yeah, it is within his whatever his silhouette or whatever they use. He's trying to turn away, he's not trying to make himself bigger, so yeah, I can see the complete frustration for Shonan, but yeah, I didn't think this was a penalty.
No, fair enough. And so still 1-1. And in the 78th minute, Dan, when Wellington has powered in a trademark header from well beyond the penalty spot to put Belmare back in front, well, Kashua must have thought, well, yeah, their luck had run out. This was an absolute, fantastic header from Wellington. And he's made quite an impact since his return. And I guess at this point in the game, you could have been excused for Kashua's heads to drop and for Shonan to see this game out. But as we know, that certainly was not the case.
Certainly at the time, you see that goal and you think, well, okay, Shonan have been screwed a couple times during this match, but at least they've got the winner they deserve. And I'll say, watching the highlights again in preparation for this recording and watching him slide, this is just not related to anything, but I'm always just scared whenever I see players go for that full body slide on the pitch. I just, you know, it takes a lot of bravery to do that and not... be prepared for, like, rug burns or whatever. I'm just amazed every time they do that, wet pitch or not.
Yeah, well, that was, as we said, that looked like it was going to be the winner for Shonan. Little did we know there was, nearly another half an hour of football still to be played. And, with the El-Yunusi one, Sam, you mentioned the sleeve. And, this is what makes the second Shuto Machino goal, or the second in inverted commas Shuto Machino goal, so controversial to me, as, Machino thought he'd made the game safe when he lashed in what we thought was his second goal in the 84th minute, only for VAR to intervene again. Shonan having another goal disallowed after it was determined that Machino had used his bicep to control a bouncing ball over the top, but surely this has hit his sleeve, and this felt especially harsh. If the Elyounoussi one was just unlucky, this was, to me, this was just plain wrong.
Yeah, this is a horrible decision, I thought. I thought it hits his sleeve the same. And even if it might slightly hit his arm, maybe. I mean, that's such nitpicking if you're trying to rule out a goal because it may have just clipped his arm there. I think it just, for me, it hits the sleeve. I can't believe this has been ruled out. I think it's a really disappointing decision. Very harsh on Machino and Shonan. And yeah, I just, that's the problem I have with this rule. It's very, just looking for any little thing to disallow a goal. And that's not what football should be. It should be about the goals and the entertainment. And this is just, I think this is a really poor use of technology. And that's what people will use to go against VAR and its use. Because, yeah, there's no way that sort of goal should be ruled out.
Yes, so Shonan obviously felt very hard done to, but they were still leading 2-1 as we entered second half stoppage time. So cue the madness of exactly 12 minutes of that. Takuma Ominami slid in to equalise after Yuta Kamiya slipped the ball past Kosei Tani while lying on the floor himself. That was in the 93rd minute. Then, unbelievably, Cristiano fired in from a tight angle at Tani's near post after Pedro Raul had flicked on Sasaki's long ball. That gave Raisel a 3-2 lead in the 99th minute. But wait, there's more. Pedro Raul turned in Kengo Kitazume's a square ball with the last kick of the game in the 112th minute to seal an astonishing 4-2 win for the visitors, their first win in 9 league games. They're still down in 16th, Dan, but what could this possibly mean for Raisel going forward? Is this just going to be an anomaly, do you think? Or is there, I don't know, Pedro Raul's good form here? Do you think they can take that as a positive with them moving forward, considering that Otaru Esaka has now left the club and they're sorely in need of some more spark up front? Maybe Raul has clicked at just the right time, but I don't think they can rely on too many results like this going forward, can they?
I don't think so either. I think that we've seen Osaka has been one of their few highlights this season for a team that has been trying and failing utterly to figure out how it plays without Michael Olunga. It's a win like this. I mean, to the players' credit, You play until the final whistle, and they absolutely did that. And I think that, you know, it's a result that they earned, because, you know, regardless of how, you know, aggrieved Shonan fans can feel, you know, Kashiwa still have to score those three goals to win the game. So I think that Nelsinho will take that as a positive. I think that that will be bulletin board material, you know, in the pregame locker room. I think that you just want to keep that energy up. But you know, last week's win isn't going to win you this week's game. And they do, as you've said, need to figure out what to do to replace Esaka, and that's not an easy answer at all.
Indeed. So, yeah, how do you go about summarising a game like that, Sam? If you're Bin Ukishima, the Shonan manager, I mean, yeah, what do you say to your players at training? Hopefully you gave them Monday off, but yeah, when they rock up to training on Tuesday morning, yeah, how do you pick your players up from that? And yeah, conversely, how can Nelsinho build on this result for his Raisel team?
I mean, Shonan are quite used to having to come back from adversity with decisions going against them, so maybe they just dip into that well again. But for the majority of this game, they played very well and were in control, I thought, and they just have to take those positives from it and know that this was kind of a freak result. Very rarely you're going to concede three goals in stoppage time. So they're doing very well this season. They're staying clear of relegation, so I'm pretty sure they can just carry on as they have been. And as for Kashiwa, I mean, a lot of problems for most of this game, but the one positive, I would say, was Pedro Raul's performance. He'd spent the last 6 weeks out injured. I think he was pretty much rushed back into this game. I don't think he was particularly fit, but managed to last the 90 minutes. He scored twice. He was involved in the other two with flick-ons. And yeah, so yeah, he was involved in pretty much everything. So if they can potentially build things around him, I mean, he looked a lot more potent than the likes of Angelotti, who's been playing in recent weeks, and Goya, and Osorio. They've not really create anything in terms of a potent threat up front, so maybe get Raul in, maybe get Cristiano around him. Sagawa is also back from injury, so you've got to rely on those players to fill that void, that not only the Ilunga void, but now the Osaka void. And they still have enough quality, I think, in their squad. If you look at Sendai, Oita and Yokohama, especially behind them, and you see the way that Tokushima and Shimizu play, I think they still will take confidence from this and still think they can get out of this game. But yeah, there are still massive holes, especially at the back and in central midfield.
Indeed. So Raysal actually did edge their way out of the relegation zone and up to 16th after this victory. Shonan stayed 13th in the table, and they'll have to pick themselves up in their next game after a very frustrating and disappointing ultimately result at the Lemon Gas Stadium. Okay, next we'll stay around the foot of the table with the other relegation dogfight, six-pointer from Sunday's Match Day 20 action, and it took place at Mitsuzawa, where Yokohama FC, the bottom club, hosted Shimizu. I mentioned earlier that Shimizu had failed to build on their result from Wednesday when they won away at Sendai, as here they had to come from behind to earn a 1-1 draw against the bottom club. There were some decent chances in the first half hour here. Kazuma Watanabe mishit a shot across the face of goal in the first 20 minutes, and then Yuya Takagi blasted over for the hosts. In the 27th minute, Thiago Santana flashed a header just wide after a dash down the right and a superb cross from Teruki Hara. And then Yokohama FC took the lead just before the break when the two players who had spurned their earlier chances combined. Takagi crossed from deep on the left, and Watanabe rose in the box to plant a header back across Shuichi Gonda for 1-0. After the second half was mostly one-way traffic in terms of chances, Espols grabbed the equaliser they had been threatening just inside the last 10 minutes when Yosuke Kawai sent over an outswinging corner, and Valdo stooped to power in a superb header from just inside the penalty spot, and they probably should have won it deep into stoppage time, but Yuji Rokutan produced a stunning save to deny Thiago Santana, who was a clean through, with Yota Maejima standing firm to block a follow-up shot from Ryo Takeuchi. So, Dan, yeah, I guess this is just another example of Shimizu's inconsistency throughout the season. Of these two games in the past week, yeah, away at Sendai, and then also on their travels, I suppose, but yeah, at the bottom club, Yokohama FC. Once they'd won on Wednesday, they would have... obviously, this would have been a priceless 3 points for them. But, not for the first time. They've let their supporters down and returned back to Shizuoka with just one.
Yeah, I think that you want to go to Yokohama and get those 3 points. You have to do better against the head and shoulders worst team of the league. To leave with a draw is disappointing. Shows spirit that they went in and got that point and salvaged the draw, but it just wasn't enough, and they have to do better. They're going to have, I think their next game is at home against Oita Trinidad, who are not quite as bad as Yokohama, but pretty close. If they don't take something away from that, and by something I mean a win, then I think we're going to start to ask more questions about them, because in the end they're three spots above the drop right now, but that's only a 4-point gap, and we still are only midway through the season, so they really have to start bringing up that margin.
Yeah, just another example. We say this on a weekly basis, basically these days, don't we, Sam? That Shimizu just no way consistent enough. And this, as Dan says, this is just the latest example of that.
Yeah, they really had to win this game. At this stage of the season, you consider games against Yokohama, Oita and Sendai all as kind of must-win games, especially as we said last week with Gamba going to pile up these games in hand. They're going to drag someone in, and Shimizu, why not Shimizu? The way that they've been playing, they've not really kicked into gear all season for any length of time. They've got good players. I mean, Santana, I think, is a decent striker, but still in this game, they weren't taking their chances. They had a glorious one right at the end, which Rokata saved, and then Maijin with the block, and yeah, it was just disappointing. Another disappointing performance from Shimizu, and I think you've got to give credit to Yokohama FC really, because they still, like, they had five players that missed out with COVID back in at the start of June, and none of those, well, one of those has returned, but the rest are still out, and that is including some of their key players. They also missed another player who missed out this game after testing positive. So they're really working on the bare bones, and it wasn't a great team in the first place. So for them to have gone toe-to-toe with Shimizu in the first half, they arguably shaded that first half. I really liked Yuya Takagi, actually, on the left side. Yeah, he did miss one chance, but I thought he was always open for the ball. He was their most dangerous player. And yeah, then they held on and defended manfully in the second half. So credit to them, but Shimizu are really disappointing. It's a game they really should have put to bed.
Indeed. All right, well, we'll head back up towards the top of the table and talk about Yokohama F. Marinos. I mentioned that yeah, they moved up to second with their win on Wednesday over Tosu, and yeah, they made it two wins in a week, and indeed now four on the spin in the league after they travelled down to Tokushima and returned home with all 3 points after a 1-0 victory. In the 10th minute here, homekeeper Naoto Kamifukumoto stuck out a boot to save Elber's first-time shot. 3 minutes later, Daizen Maeda lashed in a loose ball, but he was a hair offside when Ado Onaiwu shot from inside the box. And then Thiago Martins headed Marcos Junior's free kick narrowly wide at the near post. The goal came in the 27th minute from another Marcos Junior set piece. He swung in a corner. Takahiro Ogihara headed goalwards, and Koki Sugimori's attempted volleyed clearance cannoned off teammate Takeru Kishimoto's face and in for a very unfortunate Vortis own goal. Up the other end, just before half-time, Christian Batoccio tried his luck from distance, but Yohei Takaoka watched the ball onto the roof of the net, and the second half was very much devoid of chances, well, thanks mainly to a brilliant tackle from Shinosuke Hatanaka, which prevented Tokushima striker Yuki Kakita from getting a shot away with about 15 minutes to go. So, Dan, this is obviously, yeah, a new era for Yokohama F. Marinos with Ange Postecoglou no longer with the club, and you know all about that with all your engagements with the Scottish media over the last month or so. So, yeah, I guess they just keep chugging along here, F. Marinos. This probably wasn't a vintage Yokohama F. Marinos, but, yeah, at this stage, as the weather starts to warm up and, yeah, some of their rivals up towards the top of the table are away in the ACL, they're making hay while the sun shines, if you will.
I think that if you look at the two games over the last week, they had Salon Tosu, who are one of the most difficult opponents to face in the league right now, and Tokushima, who are very much a trap team. I think that you go up against Tokushima, and it's not an easy win. They're doing a lot of interesting stuff on the pitch. I think that Poyatos has them, you know, working in some good ways. You know, they're obviously still only a couple points clear of safety, and they're going to be in the survival dogfight for the rest of the season, I expect, but it's not an easy win, and I think that in some ways it's sort of harder to get past a team like Tokushima than it is to get past, you know, your Sendais, your Kashiwas, your Oitas. So for Yokohama, until the issue of the next manager, and I don't think we're going to get into those latest rumors, or was that after your last episode? I guess that was when Scott put that out. But yeah, until the new guy's in, whoever that is, They need to get the wins wherever they can, and I think that Sunday we saw, you know, they were able to get this win on the road, and that was the most important thing.
Indeed. Yeah, Dan's right there, Sam, isn't he? Yeah, Tokushima, they don't make it easy for you. So I guess, yeah, kind of a broader F. Marino's question. After Cup exits in Ange Postecoglou's final game and the first game under Hideki Matsunaga, have you noticed anything different in the way Matsunaga has set them up, or has he done anything tactically different so far to the F. Marino's outfit we had become accustomed to under Ange?
Generally, not really. You can tell that he's a little bit more cautious. I mean, Tiraton's missed the last couple of games with injury, and usually you've got, Ange would have gone with a more attacking Takano as the left back, much more going forward, but he's played Takuya Wada, is a little bit more conservative, and it just looks like some of the changes that made when they're 1-0 up, they're just a little bit more conservative than Ange would be. So for example, Marcos Junior going off and being replaced by Takuya Kida, a more defensive-minded midfield, he's done that in the last two games. So it's a little bit more tentative than Ange, but they're still approaching the games in the same manner. They're still getting in front, but maybe not necessarily going for the jugular in the way that an Ange Postecoglou team would do. But, I mean, they've got through these two fairly difficult games professionally. Tosu won, yeah, they didn't look in too much danger in this game as well. As much as Tokushima had the ball in the second half and passed it around, it didn't really look too often that Tokushima are going to break down Marinos. And, yeah, that's credit to the manager and the way he set them up defensively. Maybe it's not quite as exciting as it previously has been, but I mean, two wins, two clean sheets, you can't really argue with that.
Yeah, most definitely. All right, so we're next to Saitama Stadium, where Urawa Reds have finished off a very pleasant week for them with a 2-0 home win over Fukuoka. Urawa took a spectacular 11th-minute lead when Yoshio Koizumi, who continues to justify his place in our J1 team of the half season, spanked in a thunderous left-footed drive from 25 yards for his first J1 goal. Koizumi received a pass from Daigo Nishi, surged away from Hiroyuki Maeda's challenge and let fly, leaving Masaaki Murakami no chance in the Fukuoka goal. Great, Sam, to see Koizumi finally get that that weight off his shoulders, if you like, finally get that first Reds goal in the league, and what an absolute cracker it was.
Oh, absolutely, a terrific goal, really well taken, a great little movement, shift it out to into space and then picked his spot in the corner very well. So, yeah, great to see that. I mean, when we were picking our team, we didn't necessarily pick Koizumi based on his stats in terms of goals and assists, just kind of the general contribution he brings. But it is a fair point that players like Koizumi in those positions will be judged on the goals and assists that they score. So it is good for him to, yeah, to get onto the score sheet, and hopefully this is the first of many, because, yeah, a terrifically well-taken goal, and the link-up that him and Junker have up front has been pretty frightening, and to think that they're going to be adding Isaka to that mix in a couple of weeks is, worrying for J-League defences up and down the country.
Yes, most definitely. So Koizumi had a chance to make it to 2-0 just before the half hour, but his first-time shot from the edge of the box was straight at Murakami. But Reds did make it to 2-0 with 15 minutes left when Koya Iruki's in-swinging corner was glanced in at the near post by Takahiro Akimoto. So, Dan, yet another of the Reds youngsters getting on the score sheet in this game. Akimoto, obviously, not a natural left back, but he's doing a little bit of a Ryo Hatate here by filling in where Ricardo Rodriguez needs him. And, he's made arguably just as good an impact as Koizumi this year. He's been terrific as well, and great to see him rewarded with a terrific goal himself.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it is great to see younger players, especially coming up into Urawa's system. Obviously, he came over from Tochigi. He's not exactly homegrown, but Urawa isn't exactly a team that has prominently featured younger, and I guess, sub, say, 24, 25-year-olds for a while. I mean, we are seeing a great period of transition under Ricardo Rodriguez, and it is good to see him and Koizumi and all the players you've mentioned. It's that they are somehow turning into this incredibly fearsome-looking team. And as I've said before, and as I think I've said to other outlets, you know, it's Urawa aren't – they don't have it in them to win the league this year, I don't think, but an ACL spot and maybe a cup, maybe even two cups, that is by no means out of the question.
Dan, I think we've all been impressed with the recruitments. I mean, you had Koizumi, Akimoto, you had Junker, and then coming in we've got Schultz, Sakai, and Osaka. What's kind of been behind this recruitment drive? And how are they actually funding it as well, as we kind of thought that Urawa was struggling financially a little bit earlier in the year?
Well, it's interesting because they announced last week that they're signing Hiroki Sakai and Itaru Osaka. I should say in the last 2 weeks they've made those announcements. And Tsutomu Nishino, the technical director, he has spoken about how when he came into the club and he was starting to sort of reform the front office and to really get their scouting and recruitment up to speed. He said that if they're going to be the number one club in Japan, they need the number one front office in Japan. And I think that if Urawa are mostly owned by Mitsubishi, Mitsubishi Heavy Industries, I should specify, not automotive. And yes, Japanese companies aren't nearly as free spending with their clubs as European billionaire oil magnates, for example, just to name one that that comes to mind. But if you can put up a convincing argument to those companies and you say, well, this is how we're going to build a winning organization, they're totally willing to listen to that sort of logic. And I think that Nishino has presented this sort of data-heavy strategy. He's working with 21st Group, which is a sort of UK data intelligence consultancy firm, and they work with clubs, they work with leagues and competitions on various aspects, and they actually have Urawa listed in their case files. And it's talking about how they worked with Nishino to build, I'm reading off their website here, they built a model to capture the club's playing style requirements so they could assess target players and head coach candidates. So it was them who helped bring in Rodriguez and to figure out what sort of players they're looking for to help play the kind of style that Rodriguez wants to play. So that's where you're getting Junker and Schultz. That's where you're getting Sakai. That's where you're getting Osaka. So this isn't necessarily just the Urawa of the past where they're just throwing money and signing whoever the best available player is. They are looking for more targeted opportunities, and they are looking for the players that play the kind of football they want to play, and they're going for them really hard. And I think, as Nishino said in a press availability, the opportunity to sign Osaka's just sort of fell into their laps, and they jumped on it. So that it is really interesting to see that shift. And yes, the financial situation is rough. They did post a major loss last year. They're going to post another major loss this year, one would assume, because of the lack of fans. However, if you build your club on a really solid foundation and a really solid squad, it will pay dividends, not just in the cup competitions this year, in terms of getting into the ACL, in terms of contending for the league next year. And that's the kind of club that Urawa have said for years that they want to be. And they haven't necessarily achieved that, but it looks like they're a lot closer now than they were a year or two ago.
Yeah, really interesting stuff. And obviously one of the marquee names that they've brought in so far, with obviously more to come, is of course Kasper Junker. But we've seen in the past week, Sam, that Junker is indeed human. With 10 minutes left here in this game, Yuruki was bundled over just inside the box by Emil Salomonsson. But Murakami State Central and a save saved Juncker's spot kick. Juncker is human after all, Sam. We might struggle to believe that, but it is apparently the case. But overall then, as we wrap this game up, a satisfying game and a satisfying week for Reds. But Fukuoka, are there some worrying signs starting to set in for you?
Well, just on Juncker, I didn't think I was ever going to say a negative word about him, but that penalty was atrocious. maybe take him off them or me. But as for Avispa, I mean, they were without Tatsuki Nara at the back, which is an issue. I mean, Daikinmi is a decent player, but that partnership has been very solid for them this season. And they brought back John Mary up front, who previously has looked quite dangerous, but I think he was slightly lacking fitness. He didn't really cause too many problems. And yeah, Avispa have just got into this bit of a malaise just before that international break and coming out of it again. They've slipped pretty quickly to 10th. Which is kind of maybe a bit where they were expected to be, or still a little bit higher. But yeah, I just don't think they're looking like they're going to be able to maintain the momentum that they had at the start of the season, where they were nicking goals based on set pieces. And that is going to even itself out. I think you can't rely on that. And I think they are going to be dragged back towards them, the lower reaches of the table. They've still probably done more than enough at the moment to steer clear of relegation. But yeah, I think this might be a tougher period for Avispa Fukuoka fans after the dizzying heights of the first half of the season.
Yeah, I don't know. Obviously, we haven't had you on for quite a while, Dan, so you haven't had a chance to share your thoughts on Fukuoka's season so far. Obviously, yeah, they did hit the heights of fifth and stayed there for quite a few match days. But as Sam said, it has been quite a rapid tumble. It's now no wins in four as they've slid down the table to 10th. As Sam says, still relatively comfortable in terms of points. But, yeah, their supporters will be, I guess, slightly frustrated. They would have been accustomed to the successes that they had earlier on in the season. But, performance like this, especially on Sunday, where they really didn't appear to trouble Reds too much, might have some Fukuoka supporters a little bit concerned.
I think that just they need to measure their expectations a bit more. There are really few clubs in the J-League that can trouble Urawa in the form that they're in. So I don't think that that's particularly shameful. I think that for Avispa, anything better than staying up, anything better than avoiding relegation is a successful season, and I think they just have to stay focused on it. I don't think, from what I've seen of them this season, that they are the fourth or below worst team in the league. I think they'll be fine. It's going to be a bumpy ride, but they'll manage, and I think that it's just about finding consistency, getting those wins when you can, and just trying to build a steadier foundation to improve on next season.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. I don't mean to set any alarm bells off amongst the Fukuoka support. After all, they are playing with house money at this stage of the season with a very healthy tally of 29 points on the board from their 20 games so far. But their supporters will have been frustrated they didn't put up a slightly better performance at Saitama Stadium on Sunday. But they'll dust themselves off and move on to the next game. And we'll move on to our final two games from Sunday. Both were convincing home victories. First at the Kashima Soccer Stadium, Antlers swept aside Consadole Sapporo 4-0. Antlers were quick off the mark here and took a 10th minute lead rather when Tomoya Inukai powered home a header from Ryotaro Araki's corner. Araki himself and Sean Madoy wasted golden chances to make it 2-0 before the break, but 3 minutes into the second half, Diego Pachuca finished clinically past Takanori Sugano for his first J1 goal after a fellow Brazilian Everaldo chested down, and Pachuca surged through on goal. So a great moment for Pachuca, Sam, and very clear to tell from his celebrations, a very teethy grin. He's obviously been to Roberto Firmino's dentist.
Yeah, it looked like it. But, I mean, yeah, it was a really good finish. He obviously went to, well, not necessarily Roberto Firmino's finishing classes for the way he played last season. But, yeah, it was a good finish from Pachuca, just striding on past Komai and very calm in front of goal. And, yeah, took his goal very well. I think he's come in. It's taken him a little bit of time to kind of get settled, I think, in that midfield. But he's ousted Kento and Misao, by the looks of it. They've gone with the Brazilian pair in midfield, and he looks very good. And this was just a game where everything clicked for Kashima, and they faced a Sapporo side that did just fall apart, which they want to do occasionally whenever they fall behind quite early. But yeah, I thought Pituca played really well. Everaldo is getting back towards where his best is. I mean, he was involved in 3 goals in this game, and yeah, it was just everything worked well for Kashima. And yeah, Sapporo just kept attacking, kept taking defenders off, and kept conceding goals.
Yeah, fair enough then. So there was another first J1 goal for Antlers just past the hour as they made it 3-0 and killed the game. This time, young right-back Keigo Tsunemoto was the scorer, tapping home a loose ball from 6 yards after Everaldo again dribbled into the box but lost the ball just as he shaped to shoot. But after 2 assists, the big man Everaldo was not to be denied in the 68th minute, blasting home through traffic for his first league goal of a very testing campaign. And Dan, you could see how much it meant to him. He certainly loves a goal as the big man, and he certainly celebrated this one with gusto. And this, I think, Pituca getting off the mark perhaps, and Everaldo hopefully rounding into some form, makes Antlers a very interesting prospect, I think, for the ACL places in the second half of the season.
I agree. I think that Antlers have looked decent, and if you look at the standings, they're only 5 points back of Nagoya, even on games played. So, you know, they've still, when they get going, which we saw on Sunday, you know, they can be very scary. It just about getting everything clicking. You know, you did have a managerial change, and that's, sometimes that sends teams into a further tailspin, but you know, for Antlers, it seems to have reinvigorated them. And I guess we'll just see if Soma can pilot them through the second half of the season.
Yes, indeed. All right, so hanging on to the coattails, or maybe latching onto the coattails, I guess, of the battle for the ACL spots now, are FC Tokyo, who moved up to 8th after their 3rd straight win. This was at home at Ajinomoto Stadium on a Sunday evening against the second bottom team, Oita. Tokyo's Tridente combined to give them a 24th minute lead. Adailton dashed in from the left and passed to Leandro, who played a 1-2 with Diego Oliveira before letting fly from 25 yards. The shot taking a deflection off Sego Kobayashi's boot and arcing over William Pop before kissing the woodwork on its way in. And before we move on to the rest of these goals, Dan, and the way Tokyo killed this game off, it's for the two of us as Tokyo supporters, I'm sure you share my sentiments that it's just great that the manager, Kenta Hasegawa, appears to have buried the hatchet with Leandro and got him back in the team, because you can see what difference he's made in the past 3 games as Tokyo's results have taken a turn for the better.
Actually, that is exactly what I wanted to bring up, which is that just seeing Leandro back in form, back on the pitch, starting again, you can see how much it brings to this side. You can see how enthusiastic he is about getting out there and performing. Obviously, he has had several cases of Twitter fingers over the last few months. I guess weeks is a fair assessment. And whatever happened between him and Hasegawa, it worked, and Tokyo are better off for it.
Most definitely. So were any hopes Trinita had of getting back into the game were severely hampered when Yuto Misao was shown a straight red card in the 35th minute for raising his studs at a bouncing ball and catching Keigo Higashi up around the face. Sam, I guess it's one of those where ultimately Misao can't really have too many complaints, can he? I mean, the ball was in the air for a long time. You could see Misao checked that Higashi was coming at him, but yet still raised his studs. And whether there was much contact at all with Higashi, I mean, that is serious foul play, isn't it? And although he hung around for a bit on the pitch, I don't think he really had much of an argument, did he?
No, that's a clear red card for me. I mean, it's dangerous play. You can't put your studs that high onto someone and think you can get away with it. The only way he might be a little bit annoyed is if he watched the highlights of the Kashima-Sapporo game and saw Arano do exactly the same thing, have a VAR review and get away without a card. So maybe we'd like a little bit of consistency, but just on this incident on its own, yeah, a definite red card. And any hopes that Oita had of getting back into this game were pretty much gone from there, as Tokyo kind of saw out the game very professionally from that point on.
Well, actually, I'm glad you mentioned that Arano incident, because I've just realised that we forgot to play the outro of the VAR jingle. So without any further ado, that was This Week in VAR. Okay, so with Oita down to 10 men, Dan, I was very surprised, I'm not sure if you were as well, that in a very un-Tokyo-like fashion, they actually went out and put the game to bed very quickly. Dialton and Masato Morishige did spurn gilt-edged chances to make it 2-0, but Diego Oliveira did the trick in the 45th minute with a superb header from Higashi's cross in from the right. And then just 2 minutes after the restart, Ryoya Ogawa, or a Japan national team player Ryoya Ogawa, as the DAZN commentators love to tell us, lashed in a volley from just inside the penalty spot after Kashif Bangunagunde's cross from the left was pushed away by Pop. So, yeah, this was very un-Tokyo-like. They actually, they had an advantage in the game and they actually made the most of it.
It's the last home field advantage they're getting for 2 or 3 months, so you might as well make use of it. Which, you know, let's just briefly touch on that, the fact that they're dealing with another really long stretch away from home for the third season in a row. You know, it's not a position that you want the team to be put into. It can't be helped. I think that they've stepped up to take the hit as the sort of Olympic host city representative club, as the Rugby World Cup home representative club. You know, it's hopefully those favors and the sentiment get cashed in. Hopefully the karma comes back to the team. Because they've got, what, 7-8 games on the road now? And that's really where they're going to be tested, because we're hitting summer, we're hitting 110% humidity, there's going to be who knows what coming in. You know, if they happen to lose Tagawa to the Olympic team, they're just going to be short another weapon. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, most definitely. So this scoreline could have easily been 5 or 6 with Higashi sliding in and missing when it looked easier to score, and Dialton blasting against the post after a mazy dribble. But ultimately a 3-0, basically a cakewalk for FC Tokyo at home against Oita. But Sam, I'm certainly not getting carried away, and I'm sure Dan would agree. I mean, these past three wins have come against the teams currently 20th, 15th, and now 19th in the table. You can only beat the teams in front of you, and now it's 4 unbeaten. Tokyo up to 8th, as I mentioned, and kind of latching onto the coattails of the race for the ACL places. 6 points behind 3rd place Nagoya, and just 3 behind Kobe and Urawa. But I don't know. Yeah, Dan and I have spoken about Tokyo here. So Oita, this was just one of those where, although they were decent enough in the first 10 minutes, once the first goal went in, and then obviously they lost Masao, they were on a hiding to nothing, and they'll just look to put this result past them as soon as possible.
Yeah, this is just one that they just put it down to. Yeah, nothing we really could have done about it. Once they went down to 10 men at 1-0, they still had to have they went more damage limitation than ever trying to get back into the game, and that didn't really work as they lost 3-0. I mean, they're not the most threatening team at the best of times, but when they were down to 10 men, yeah, there was no way this was going to turn into an Oita victory, and their focus will be very much on the game against Shimizu, which, proper relegation 6-pointer if Oita are going to be able to drag themselves out of their current predicament.
Indeed. And, before we wrap things up, Sam, in the green room, there was a question from you knocking about that you wanted to ask Dan that That completely took me by surprise. We mentioned that Tokyo are 3 points behind Kobe. Is it possible that an ex-Tokyo favourite might be joining Vissel? This has caused me quite a deal of distress, I must say. Certainly hope this doesn't come to pass. But, yeah, if you want to ask Dan, I'll be interested to know if he can shed any light on it.
Yeah, I think it might have been Dan that I saw the rumour from. Correct me if I'm wrong there. But, yeah, talks of Yuto Nagatomo joining Vissel Kobe. Do you think that's a likely transfer to take place? And what are FC Tokyo doing? Are they not looking to try and bring him back to Ajinomoto Stadium?
It's a very good question. The report out there is that Vissel Kobe are preparing 200 million yen, which is pretty close-ish to $2 million U.S. dollars for Nagatomo. You know, is he a good fit for their squad? I don't know. Can Tokyo afford that much money? Probably not. Will any European clubs want to match such a bid if they want to keep Nagatomo on? And I love Nagatomo. Ben loves Nagatomo. I think our opinions on Yuto Nagatomo are very well established, and we wish him a long career, a long and continued career, I should say. But he is getting up there, and he doesn't quite have the endurance that he once did. You know, he's an older player. He's starting to suffer from wear and tear. So can he keep it up in Europe? I'm not quite sure. But certainly the performance of Bangu Nagande on Sunday should reassure Tokyo fans that even if Nagatomo doesn't come back home, and again, speaking as a Tokyo fan, I do hope he does, then they do have someone at that position at left back who can perform well and who can sort of carry that torch. So you know, it's really tough to say. That it may turn out to be that this is just sort of smoke and mirrors and a bit of agent posturing. So, you know, we'll see how the window shakes up when clubs are allowed to start registering players in, I guess, mid-July.
Yeah, really hope this doesn't happen. But I could certainly understand Nagatomo wanting to bring his young family back to Japan. But he probably has pretty ordinary memories of the changing rooms at the Kodaira training facility, so I can understand he wouldn't want to be heading back to that unless they've been renovated since the last time I visited. But I'm sure, yeah, all Tokyo supporters, if he comes back to the J-League, would only love to see him back at FC Tokyo. But he obviously goes anywhere with our best wishes. He is always an FC Tokyo fan favourite. All right, well, that's the six games from Sunday then. Sam, was there anything else you wanted to pose to Dan before we wrap things up?
No, I think I'm just looking through. I think I got all my questions to Dan. Yeah, thanks very much for answering all of those.
All right, terrific stuff then. So all that's left for us to do then is to ever so briefly look ahead to match day 21, where yet again there will be six games played from that match day, four of them on Saturday and then two on Sunday. Sam, I guess we better let you do your pick of the weekend, and then I guess Dan, you can guess along. You're the originator of this game, so you can see if you pick correctly for the fixture that Sam has chosen.
Well, first of all, no points for guessing the one I'm least looking forward to, the early kickoff on Sunday, giving me a 5 a.m. start. Thank you very much, Consadole. But yeah, the game I'm going to have to pick is Kashiwa versus Yokohama. I mean, yeah, after coming back from the jaws of defeat against Shonan, how can they carry that on? Have they got an encore in them? And yeah, Yokohama F. Marinos, just they going on, they're up into second. I mean, if they keep winning their games in hand, they're 6 points behind Kawasaki. Can we dream of a title challenge, maybe? But yeah, I think that's, for me, is head and shoulders above the rest of the games this weekend.
I wouldn't have expected anything different if you look at this slate. I think that the only reason you would watch Sendai Urawa is to see how many great goals Urawa will put up, because I'm sure they'll put up quite a few. Nothing else really speaks to me on a metaphysical level. So, you know, I haven't put in my application yet, but if I go to a game, it'll be Kashiwa Yokohama for sure.
All right, terrific stuff. Well, I just did want to mention a couple of the games that myself, not that they're necessarily great for a neutral to be tuning into, but on Saturday, Hiroshima in ninth host a sixth place Tosu. And I want to mention both of them, listeners, because, we've hardly mentioned them at all since J1 returned from the international break. In the three rounds that have taken place since J1 resumed, both Hiroshima and Tosu have only played once each. So it's great to see them back on the pitch at the Edion Stadium. And then our weekly dose of a relegation six-pointer is on Sunday at Nihon Daira when Shimizu in 14th host second from bottom Oita. So, we'll see how things go there at Nihon Daira. Shimizu up and down, obviously, and Oita pretty flat in recent times. But that game could be anything. All right, well, we'll leave it there for this episode of the podcast. But Dan, you're obviously going to be so busy in the next month, 6 weeks or so. What have we got to look forward to from you? Both before the Olympics get going, but then also once everything kicks off.
I hope you have a lot to look forward to. It's been a quiet start to the week. I guess last week I wrote my piece on former Nadeshiko player Kumi Yokoyama's coming out as transgender. It was a very brave and admirable thing for them to do. Just a huge thing, just a breakthrough moment for LGBTQ people in Japan, for the community in Japan, and for athletes in Japan. So go check that piece out if you haven't read it, which a lot of people already have and said lots of kind things, and I'm very appreciative of that. What else is coming out? I actually just interviewed current Nadeshiko members, Saori Takarada of the Washington Spirit and Honoka Hayashi, who's a backup member at AIK in Sweden. So I just talked to them for an hour today, and that'll be part of my pre-Olympic coverage. And, things are a bit wild on the Olympic beat, so we're just sort of taking it as it comes. And the Japan Times team is going to be putting out a lot of cool stuff. My colleagues, Jason Koskri and Kaz Nagatska, we're all going to be pumping out content 24/7, essentially, in the lead-in and during the games and after them, and even into the Paralympics, where I'm going to be doing photography and all sorts of cool stuff. So follow all that. Get a subscription. Keeps me off the streets. Keeps my uniform collection ever expanding. And
Yeah, brilliant stuff. Well, yeah, we wish you all the best for what's to come. If we don't speak before the Olympics get going, we know you're going to be flat out. So first and foremost, enjoy the experience because, obviously they don't come around very often, do they, Olympics in the country you reside in. So make sure you make the most of it, even though you're going to be flat out. But, stay safe and, just enjoy it, I guess, is my message. I don't know, Sam, you have any parting words for Dan before we finish the episode?
Yeah, I wish him all the best. I hope he doesn't get overworked too much and that Celtic don't dip into the J-League for a few J-League signings to take him elsewhere.
I'm actually on Wednesday, Ange is doing a press availability for Japanese and Australian press, so I'm going to get to say hi and maybe ask a couple questions about how life is over there in the Glasgow fishbowl. He did very well in that in his local media press conference on Friday, that the answer about or his response to the question about whether Scotland is a jump from Japan and Australia, his answer was really good, and the fans seem to have really gotten on board the Ange train, so that's always great to see.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. All right, well, enjoy it again, Dan, and thanks again for your time on this week's episode. We really appreciate it.
Anytime. Look, you know, whenever JTalk shows up on my phone, I'm always ready to answer.
That's absolutely brilliant. All right, so that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I would very much like to thank Dan Ulowitz for his time on this episode. Thanks to Alex Bishop for his question, and thanks to all of our patrons for their support on Patreon. If you'd like to get involved, please head to patreon.com/JTalkPod. Sam, that's it then, and we'll reconvene next week after another J1 match day.
Yeah, look forward to it. A relatively quiet week for me, which is pretty interesting. So I'm going to enjoy that. Hope you do too. Yeah, and speak to you next week.
All right, terrific. I just realised I've done my outro out of order there, but we'll leave it as is, and we'll sign off for now. So, yeah, we'll be back next week to round up J1 Match Day 21. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast. Yes, 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 yes.